outside the box of religious obligation lies a road less travelled, into the heart of the Father's affection. Slinging freedom all over the place, this is the God Gym.
Better to suffer injustice than to do it.
Better to suffer injustice than to do it. Okay, I like it.
I wish they would have said to cause it. Better to suffer injustice than to cause it, but they just said than to do it.
Where did that come from?
A movie called A Hidden Life. Have you seen it?
Ooh, I have not. No.
I had neither. Bob Prater was talking about it the other day, and I thought, you know what? So Sarah and I dove into part of it last night. It's a three-hour movie.
Oh, wow.
It's about an Austrian resistor to Nazi Germany and gets conscripted into the military and then supposed to take a loyalty oath to Hitler, cannot do it. And that's the plot of the book, movie. We haven't got the end of it yet, so I can't even do a spoiler alert because I don't know how it ends. I think I know how it ends, but I haven't seen it. And all we've been talking about with justice later, earlier, what a phrase, better to suffer injustice than to do it. Because most people would think the opposite. Better to do injustice before it gets done to you. That would be how our world works.
It's interesting. The justice conversation has kept coming up a lot recently. I went to a local church service with Jess and the family this last weekend, and then have been listening to a couple of podcasts that I listen to on a fairly regular basis. And the word righteousness keeps coming up in the passages that they're reading. And I keep subbing it for justice. And I'm like, oh, it's so much better. It's so like, I don't know. It keeps surprising me on how it keeps engaging with my life as of late.
Yeah, I recorded a podcast this morning for Europe, and we got into some of that discussion there as well. So,
ooh, interesting.
We've hit it heavier here. Yeah, I guess I'm just really tuned into the word injustice these days. And he certainly is suffering injustice, and he's certainly being despised by his own countrymen. You'd think, you know, he lives in this little village, and they all just, why are you making waves? Just shut up and go along, get this over with. And all the other guys have gone off to war, so he needs to. And so he finally gets conscripted. He goes in, but then the loyalty oath is more than he can do. He just can't do it.
Wow.
Yeah. Seems like a pretty strange way to do it. At one point, he's approached by a captain. He's in prison at this point. And the captain says to him, are you better than the rest? Are you alone wise? How do you know what is good or bad? You know better than I. Did heaven tell you this? And just the intimidation and what I hear, because I hear that same thing from people all the time who are following a conscience that doesn't subscribe to the religious norm. And that's the kind of stuff that's always brought up. Who do you think you are? You think you're better than the rest of us because you're following your conscience? Are you alone wise? The rest of us are idiots because we're going along with this thing and you're not. And it's amazing how someone who doesn't conform becomes a threat to those who want to. And the stuff they'll pull out, I've heard pastors actually say, do you think you're closer to God than I am? If what you're saying is true, don't you think I would know it? God would show me before he shows you? And just how much we seek to intimidate people to get them back in the line. And one of the things we'd prayed about a couple weeks ago with the group I pray with is how much intimidation will keep brothers and sisters from following through on what God's leading them to do, because it's just intimidating. And spent a lot of time just praying that people would have the courage to follow through on the things God's revealing to them and not be intimidated by the voices that are trying to intimidate them, so they'll shut up and get in line.
And it's interesting because I feel like there's this hand in hand between intimidation and discouragement or despair. And so it's like these two play off of one another, where there's that intimidation of who do you think you are and trying to diminish them. And then there's the discouragement or the despair of I've tried this, or I start dipping my toe in faith out into that direction or start moving in that direction. And then we just get slammed with one obstacle after another, or just the sense of despair that comes in the midst of that. And that, man, I think those two really are entangled with one another in the enemy's process.
Do you think the despair feeds off expectations that if this is God, it ought to be easier than this? Instead of the reason most other people aren't doing it is because God leads us down roads that seem to be a lot more painful than we would normally choose for ourselves.
Yes, I would agree with you. I think that there is the illusion that if we are going to follow after Father's heart, that it's going to be pain-free, or that it's going to be void of obstacles or challenges. Because I think any time the light starts to move in the world, the darkness is not thrilled about that and will definitely try to oppose it, diminish it, intimidate it, scare it, whatever it needs to do
to
try to keep it
at
from
any level. Yeah.
Yeah. To try to get us to stop, to stop that traction, to stop that momentum, to suppress the still small voice, that those nudges that would incline us to be a catalyst of the kingdom in the world.
Yeah, and especially in this instance here of this captain who done him, it kind of appeals to someone's sense of humility or whatever. How dare you think you know more? And mostly when you're following conscience, it isn't any sense of I know more, I've got a better view of this. I feel constrained to walk a direction that I know will not be popular with friends and family and people who find that point of view threatening to whatever environment, particularly if it's, I can't be a part of this congregation anymore, that's somehow going to be a negative judgment against those who still are. And
yeah,
it sets up these false accusations that make people who are humble of heart anyway feel intimidated or even, like you say, discouraged. I like when Paul says, pray for me. There are many open doors, but there are many enemies. And mostly we think of open doors as there's no enemy here. This is easy. Instead of, you know what? We're going to learn obedience to the things that we suffer. There's a hostility in the world against God's way of doing things. I just think we need to arm ourselves with that and keep that in mind. And then when things get dark and difficult, you go, okay, this is why other people don't go this way, because it's dark and difficult.
It was interesting that in the service that I was taking part in this weekend, one of the things that came up was talking about God testing us and putting us through trials and tribulations. And he referenced James, and he was going through, he was kind of all over the map. He referenced James. He was talking about a couple of the churches in Revelation. And I was thinking about it, and I was like, don't the trials and the challenges come because we live in a broken world? Like, isn't that like what, because James goes on to say our Heavenly Father who gives perfect gifts and doesn't give us those trials. Like it continues on. Mid second chapter, he starts talking about that. And I'm like, hold on a second. We're missing something here, because he talks about the Father of Heavenly Light who gives good and perfect gifts. And that is in contrast to the person who gives trials and tribulations versus the joy, the courage, the peace to walk through the trials and tribulations that we are going to face in this world.
Yep, for sure. What about you? Best thing you heard this week?
I had a wonderful experience with my daughter, Evie. So she's our youngest. She's almost 3. And
wow, growing right up.
And I was in the kitchen, we were cooking, and I had some different music scores playing in the background because I like to listen to music scores.
What are music scores exactly?
So like music
6
soundtrack.
To 3, classic over rock, or
no, just like
kidding.
musical theme songs.
Most people just say I like listening to music. Musical scores was interesting.
Yes.
Very high class language.
Movie scores. When I go to search it on iTunes, that's what I search is movie scores. And I would play a song and Evie would respond, "This is a really sad song, Daddy." I knew the song. I knew the movie that it was playing from and the scene that it was playing from. And she was right. And so then I played another song and it came up and she's like, this movie, this is very intense, kind of scary, Daddy. And again, she was exactly right. And it was so cool she's very aware of how music impacts emotion. And it was really intriguing to watch that because she loves to dance. Anytime good music comes on, she loves to dance. She loves to move. And yet watching her process the impact of music on emotion was really intriguing as she and I were cooking together. So that was a very interesting next level self-awareness that I got to watch my 2-year-old go through.
She's waiting for the lighthearted song so she can dance.
That's right. She was. She was listening for some Encanto music or something that had some good beat to it.
Yeah. Well, I'm Wayne Jacobson.
And I'm Kyle Rice.
And welcome to this episode of The God Journey.
So I am not sure if you have fully read it yet. I know I introduced this idea to you a couple of weeks ago, but the book, The Anxious Generation, Jonathan Haidt. Heard of it? Encountered it? Any experience with it at all?
Just other than our conversation, I've read some Jonathan Haidt stuff before. I think the guy really has some brilliant research and some really good ideas for our culture.
Okay. So what books have you read in the past before from him?
Oh, yeah. Put me on the spot. I don't even. What the name of that book? I read his first one.
Okay.
Whatever that was.
Because I want to go back and read some of his other stuff because I got introduced to The Anxious Generation because I was having lots of conversations with people about cell phones, media, culture, how it's impacting the youngest generation, impact on mental health, parenting, and what does that look like? And it kept coming up. Well, have you read The Anxious Generation? Have you read The Anxious Generation? And I couldn't say yes to them. So I had to pursue this. And it is an absolutely phenomenal book. It really explores the impact of two different worlds, two different generations, two different ways of growing up. And he titles them the real world versus the phone world.
Oh.
And it's intriguing, Wayne. It, like, in some ways, it was very affirming to things that I had already seen or had known or other research that I had read. And in other ways, it was honestly incredibly humbling and challenging to me as a dad, as an educator, as somebody who works with young people on a regular basis. It was very eye-opening.
And The Anxious Generation, what ages is he encompassing in that?
Primarily looking at Generation Z. So those would be individuals that grew up during the iPhone generation. So that were experiencing earlier childhood by 2010. And so it's that generation that's had that impact of media, of social media, smartphones on their life in the day to day. And he talks a lot about the great rewiring. That's the term that he uses. And it starts in the data, the research shows that it starts in 2010 when the first iPhone came out with a forward facing camera. So a camera that was actually facing the person that was holding the phone.
Oh, and that started this great rewiring, did it?
That was the distinction between the two. So there was some change when there was smartphones that had a camera on them. But as the research has been evaluated and the impact on young people, their mental health, their emotional state, it really targets to that starting date of 2010 when iPhone 4, I believe, came out.
Man, it just does seem like it was longer ago than that. 2010 didn't seem that far. It was 15 years, but still, we didn't have it before then, huh?
We did not. And there's been amazing. A lot of feedback about how that impacts young people and the way that it rewires their brain. And so I want to throw a couple of things, attributes, characteristics out to you and kind of get your feedback on it. So he talks about the distinction between real world relationships, and he characterizes those things as having these four elements. So first, they are embodied. So we use our bodies to communicate and we're conscious of the bodies of other people around us. So that's the first one. Second is our relationships are synchronous. So they're happening in real time and we're getting real time feedback.
Okay.
Third, they involve one-to-one or one-to-several communication, but there's only one interaction at a given moment. So if you and I are talking, then there's one, I'm currently communicating to you. So there's one interaction that's taking place and then you're giving me feedback, et cetera. And so there's that one-to-one, one interaction that's taking place.
So there could be other people listening in on it, though.
Yes.
You could be a small group, but one person generally talking at the time. It's not like a room where everybody's got 40 different conversations going on.
Okay. Exactly. Exactly. And even in that room, if everybody was talking at the same time, he would judge it by the people who were directly engaged with one another, and that they're not aware of all the other things that are going on across the room.
Okay.
And then finally, these relationships take place in community that has a high bar for entry and exit, meaning that people are highly invested in relationships and they're willing to repair relationships if damage occurs.
Oh.
So those are the four basic elements of what he titles real world relationship.
Okay.
That has been happening in human sociology for several hundred years. Then we transition to what he calls the virtual world. So it's disembodied. Yep. So that means we just need language. So I could be communicating with an AI bot. I could be communicating with an avatar. I could be communicating with a real human being. But the communication is just language. Now, FaceTime calls or Zoom calls like what we're doing now, that's excluded from that because we can read some nonverbal cues and that kind of thing. So it's a little different. It is the interactions are heavily asynchronous, meaning the feedback is not happening in real time. There's a delay, there's a pause, there's an interpretation that's happening in the feedback before there's actually any kind of response. There is one to many communication. So you could have a vast audience that you are projecting this out to, and those interactions can be happening a lot all the time. So I could be live streaming to numerous different people at the same time, and they could all be messaging me back, and I wouldn't be able to connect with all those messages simultaneously. And then finally, relationship happens in communities with a very low bar for entry and exit, meaning people can block, they can quit, they can exit, and relationships are deemed as disposable.
Ooh, just like this podcast, right?
Oh, I mean, hopefully not, but
download it or you don't, you listen to it or not.
Yep, the relationship's disposable, right?
So if we charged $100 per listen, that would give it some.
I know, you got to get some advertising and get some skin in the game. Monthly subscriptions.
No, don't go to ads. Don't do that. I now have all these people writing me telling me how to get rid of ads on my computer.
So what is your initial, how does it initially land for you as you're listening through the comparison between the real world relationships versus the virtual relationships? How does that land for you?
Some of the virtual, and I'm worried about this because when, particularly when you get to one to many, mm-hmm. That's been a valued Christian communication tool, whether it's seminars, churches, whatever, one person standing, everybody else listening, note-taking, whatever, but there's no interaction. So I thought mm-hmm. we've had some of that prior to this.
Mm-hmm.
The other stuff, I can definitely see that you're not having the exchange, the interaction, the investment in a conversation. Instead, you're stuff's kind of there's a lot of stuff happening, and even people's attention may be partly to hear, but then partly listening over here or see your video, your thing from your whatever. And then they've got 15 other people they're following. They're listening to all those too. And so I'm interested in how that rewires the brain, because I'm very sensitive to how trauma has rewired Sarah's brain and just what we've learned in the last 3 years, how much the same stimulus comes to her. Her mind handles it very different than mine does.
Yes.
And that's not something I really thought, gosh, everybody processes life pretty much the same way. It's just whatever choices you're making. But to actually see that the wiring shifts in a way that's now physiological, it's not just mental. It's actually the way the brain operates. So I'm really interested into how that virtual world affects that.
So that's a great segue, because one of the biggest harms that it talks about is the assumption by older generations that they need to just get over it. That, oh, it's just another younger generation that, you know, back in our day, we didn't have these challenges, or back in our day, we didn't have this mental health issues. And I even got in a conversation with a good friend of mine just this last week, and we were talking about mental health in our community. And she started dialoguing a little bit about the conservative party, government party, that is very active in Wyoming right now, that has connections to the CPAC and some different things there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to be presenting to a major board here in my local area about mental health in our community. And this community member, who is highly influential, made the comment, well, don't talk about mental health and caring for the needy in our community, because they don't want to hear that conversation. They don't want to hear that, oh, they're struggling, or that they're having mental health issues. Their response to you is going to be, that's their problem. Now, if you can talk to them about the diminishment of the family and how this is going to serve the economy of our local community, they'll be all in. But if you start talking about the mental health challenges, specifically of the younger generation, and how to start intervening, they are not even going to listen to you, which is real. I mean, it's mind-blowing to me, because we're talking about an actual neurological rewiring in attention span, in resilience, in the ability to be able to connect with other people, how we connect with other people, the ability to be able to read nonverbal cues and communication with other people. We're talking a full rewiring of the brain.
Wow.
One of the biggest areas that this has been seen in specifically is play. And how young people play. And so Jonathan Haidt points towards the research about high-risk play, or unscripted play, or unsupervised play, and how starting back in the late 80s, early 90s, there was this big push, this fear of what was going to happen to young people, of they're going to get kidnapped, or they're going to get hurt, or they're going to get like all these different things. And so there was this big movement, which they sociologists deemed the helicopter parent, where they were hovering over their kid and not allowing them to have any issues or have any challenges or have any mistakes. And that what they saw in the research was they're starting to see this impact on people, on young people's resiliency, on young people's ability to have critical thinking skills, on social interactions, because play started getting much safer. Well, then fast forward to when they started introducing cell phones and started introducing smartphones, and they saw this dynamic shift, not only in the way that young people were playing, but also there was this correlation between very, very scripted, sculptured, very, very protected play in the real world, and yet almost no protection whatsoever in the digital world. That parents were handing kids devices, whether it be a gaming system that had internet access to it. So starting with PlayStation 3 and Xbox 360, those gaming consoles had full access to the internet. So young people could do whatever they wanted to through these gaming systems. Then you saw the introduction of the smartphone in 2000, or the iPhone 4 in 2010. And there's just this major shift in the way young people started to interact and engage with the world around them.
Wow. So how does that, I mean, this is a generation you teach. So you interact with this group all the time.
Yes.
How do you see the symptoms of this anxious generation in the people that you educate?
A wide variety. So first of all, we're seeing a significant boom in anxiety disorders, depressive disorders, and self-harm and suicide rates. So we're seeing a huge uptake. If you go onto the Anxious Generation website, Jonathan Haidt has posted a lot of the research and data that both parents and educators can look at in regards to what is happening with young people. And so in 2010, you see the start of what looks like a hockey stick that's laying down with the end of the hockey stick pointing up, in regards to the increase in what they call internalizing disorders. So previously, young, like men specifically, boys had a lot of externalizing disorders. So when you were talking about guys and mental health issues and how to help them navigate that, largely you saw behavioral issues. So things that were externalized, you saw them acting out, whether it be anger, aggression, high-risk behavior, that type of thing.
Right.
With women, it was internalizing disorders. So anxiety, depression, and the way So you'd see a lot of non-suicidal self-injury or suicide attempts with a low level of lethality. So again, those cries for help or right. that diminishment, right? But starting in 2010, they saw a major shift where both men and women started displaying higher levels of internalizing disorders. So they started seeing an uptake in just from between 2010 and 2015, there was a 150% increase in suicide attempts in males from between 10 to 25. 150% in 5 years. Yeah. That is a significant increase. And so one of the way some of the other characteristics that I see with young people is their lack of their ability to be able to connect with each other in person. And so even I was joking with one of my college students the other day that they were a young woman was lamenting about not being able to have any kind of positive romantic interaction with a male here on campus. And so they were processing that with me and they said, oh, the only thing they want to do is talk to me via online. They just want to Snapchat with me, or they just want to message me, or they're trying to get me to send nudes, or, you know, those types of things mm-hmm. where they're again, falling under that virtual world community. There's a low bar for entry and exit. There isn't that commitment. There isn't that desire to try to repair a relationship if there's some kind of rift that occurs. It's disposable. And so you see these relationships where they get into these things. There's a illusion of emotional connection that's taking place online, and yet the interpersonal interaction is not happening at all or very little.
And if the brain's being rewired, you say they don't have the capacity for that? Or is it something that can be trained? People could learn how to do that?
It can be addressed. Yes, it can be learned. And there's a lot of research and techniques that have gone into this that are also included in this book that are phenomenal resources. But it's going to take a lot of intentionality on parents' parts, on young people's parts who say, I'm not willing to continue with this, and on educators and in policy. So there's multiple spheres of influence within our community that are going to have to make some pretty significant changes if we're wanting to see this great rewiring stop, specifically in the generation of my daughters who are a little bit younger, that are no longer meeting the age requirements for Gen Z. But they are still, they're sitting on the cusp of whether they're going to have the same issues as Gen Z in regards to emotional, psychological, and interrelational, or if people are going to start taking action and changing those requirements.
And this is a tough time to do that because there's never been a lower sense of distrust between parents and educational community, particularly when you talk about fuzzy, quote unquote, kinds of things that's not right, reading, writing, and arithmetic. We don't trust public schools anymore to mess with the emotional well-being of the student because we've seen that go sideways in a number of areas that has caused great concern among parents.
Absolutely. Yeah. And one of the big ones, especially for educators, that the research has been showing is, first of all, having completely phone-free campuses. So they walk on campus, their phone goes into a lockbox, and it does not get released until after they walk off campus, period.
That's happening a lot in California schools right now.
And see, it's starting to move in that direction. So our local school district also started the experiment for the first time this year with their middle school and the high school to where there's no phones allowed on campus, period. So you can't see them, can't use them, can't have access to them. That's including on their lunchtime and during athletic events. So if they're at track practice or if they're basketball practice and a phone is seen, it gets confiscated and there's pretty heavy disciplinary action that occurs.
And is this going to reverse the problem? I mean, if the brain's already rewired and now you take the phone away, which is their connecting point to the world, what's the impact of that?
Incredibly positive. So they're already within just a year's time, they're seeing a dramatic change in interpersonal relationships. So students are actually talking, the volume of hallways have changed because now all of a sudden students are actually interacting with one another. They're seeing a decrease in depression and in social anxiety. They're seeing young people actually engaging in the learning experience, because one of the big things with the phone is even if they don't have it out, but they're aware of it, their brain is managing it. Their brain is managing, okay, I'm getting notifications, or I wonder who is texting me, or I wonder who is Snapchatting me right now, or I wonder what new video came up on TikTok. I mean, their brain is consciously aware of what is going on the phone, whether they see it or not. Now, if they are able to create that block of time where they say, no, you have absolutely no access to it, don't even try, don't even think about it, then they're actually seeing students release it, not worry about it, not have to manage it anymore. They're seeing students become a lot more playful and interactive with one another because they're not worried about somebody filming them and cyberbullying about it the next day or even that night. There's a much lower level of concern about how their appearance, how their relationship with others is going to be socially impacted if they allow themselves to be seen.
So some of this is fairly hopeful then. That
it is. It's incredibly hopeful.
And what does it do for people who've already been raised through that and now in their 20s? Can they reverse it in the same way?
They can. They have to start building in their own intentional relationship with cell phones and with social media and with notifications, because they need to start creating times and spaces in their life where there is no connection to the phone, where they are not managing it, where they're creating that break in their lives. Because the Gen Zs they're just in their early 20s right now. So the oldest of the Gen Zs are just in their early 20s. And so there's a lot of space for them to be able to start relearning and changing the relationship that they have with technology. But it's more difficult for the oldest portion of them, because already they have learned relational identity, they've learned dating skills, they've learned social structure, and that all has been not only molded by social media, but then catalyzed by COVID. So if they were junior seniors in high school during COVID, and then they went through the lockdown where now all of a sudden phone use is drastically increasing, and you also pair that with anxiety and social disruption and other issues, and they went through the worst of it, to be bluntly honest.
Hmm. I notice he makes a real contrast between play-based childhood and phone-based childhoods.
Yes.
And obviously I grew up in the time when no one had phones, so it was all play-based childhoods. And that kind of sets you up better to function in society?
Very much so. Not only does it increase resiliency, does it increase creative problem-solving skills, social interactions, the imagination and innovation, but it also really impacts the way that people do interpersonal relationships. So they saw and they noticed a major shift in the way that structured play occurred. So when they had very set, like, here's your playground, there's no opportunity for creativity or innovation at all, they began to see this major shift in the way that young people were relating with each other. They weren't creating, they weren't doing teamwork, they weren't communicating and problem solving together. It was all just much more structured, quote unquote, safe play. Then you introduce phones to that, and you see a dramatic change. And that was one of the big conversations as well for educators, is talking about the amount of play, unstructured play, that young people are allowed to have. And how, in comparison, our young people in the same given time as a cellmate in a max security prison gets roughly between, in today's education system, young people, K-12, are getting at best between 30 to 45 minutes of recess a day. And it's very structured. It's very safe. There are people hovering over. It's very scripted. In contrast, inmates are getting between an hour and a half to 2.5 hours of unstructured socialization and play every single day in the exact same amount of time. And when surveyed, inmates, their minds were blown that modern education right now only allows young people to be outdoors and having unscripted social play for roughly around 45 minutes a day. And that's K-12.
Wow. That's certainly not the world I grew up in.
No, and me either. I mean, that's, we had, not only did we have a lot less quote unquote safe play. I mean, I remember we got banned from one piece of equipment when I was in first grade, second grade. We got banned from this piece of equipment because my friend group, in that 1 5-day period of time, each one of us knocked ourselves unconscious at one point playing tag on this piece of equipment.
Yeah.
And eventually they're like, okay, enough. Like, you guys all have severe concussions. You all have knocked yourselves unconscious. You all have significant bruises. You need to pause on how we're playing on this playground, or we're not going to be able to face your parents and figure out what's going on here.
That's where safe place got started. People like you.
Yes, exactly.
Now we have to take this equipment out of the school. We can't use it anymore. We have rules, and
it's super padded. It's all plastic, no sharp edges, nothing that could potentially harm a young person at all. And I mean, when my family and I, when we were growing up, I am assuming it's probably the same for you, but we didn't have TV. We didn't have gaming systems. We had what's called country cable. So 2.5 public channels that you could get with the big antenna kind of a thing.
Right.
And then eventually we had movies, you know, VHS movies or DVDs. But even then we didn't have cable or any kind of structured TV. And we spent the vast majority of our time outdoors playing. And honestly, no matter what the temperature was, my parents started to put restrictions on how long we could play outside if we began to go below 0 degrees outside. That's when they started to put some regulations on how long we could be outside.
See, wouldn't that come in frostbitten?
Correct. Exactly.
Again, they didn't want us to lose limbs. Again, push the envelope too far. I thought about how much this is when we talk about love, rest, and play, how much play with God is important to wire our spiritual brains. To have that kind of engagement with God that's a little more free-flowing rather than a rules-based, principle-based, here's what God needs you to know. We've already figured out. Just do it. Keep God happy. Yeah. I've thought about that, how much that changes the nature of someone.
Well, it talks about the five harms of how this is impacting. And so the first harm is social deprivation. The second one is sleep deprivation, and that's a big one with young people. Mm. Whenever I have students do the social media fast, one of the biggest feedbacks that I get is, I actually got 8 hours of sleep, or I actually had time to do my homework, or I actually was able to get some rest. Attention fragmentation, addiction, and the fifth one, spiritual degradation. Mm. So their understanding of what is morality, what does it look like to be able to engage with humanity for a higher purpose? Mm. What does it look like to be able to have a moral system or an understanding of what it means to live for something bigger than yourself with purpose? And that's almost non-existent in a phone-based reality or a phone-based world, a virtual world.
Yeah, Sarah and I finished for the second time last night, Body Keeps the Score, reading through it with her. Yeah. In that last chapter, he said, one of the things we know that the prime reason for habitual drug use in teens is that they cannot stand the physical sensations that signal fear, rage, or helplessness.
Yeah.
That's amazing because, I mean, at that age, you have those kinds of emotions that affect your body. And if they're so abhorrent to the person, and now, it doesn't have to be addiction to drugs necessarily. It could be the phone addiction. When I'm feeling bad, I grab my phone and try to get a dopamine hit somewhere doing the thing that makes me feel better.
Correct.
And never learn to address the deeper needs inside.
Yeah. And that's, you're seeing, it's affecting guys and girls in very different ways in some regards, because initially they saw the sociological and safety impact much higher with women because of the relationships and the challenges that they were facing, the fear of how are they going to be portrayed on this large scale. So, right, all of a sudden, now it became global. So now all of a sudden, versus I had a rumor spread about me and it just went around my school building, or it just went around my class. Now it got posted with high definition video for the entire world to see. And so they saw this major impact in the way that women were engaging with the world around them. Guys, they've seen a lot more retreat. So guys are retreating into the virtual world, disconnecting in the virtual world, primarily through gaming systems. Mm-hmm. There's still definitely some interaction and engagement in regards to smartphones, social media, et cetera. But a lot of young people, specifically guys, have seen those internalizing disorders rising because the only world that they know how to quote unquote be successful in is this virtual reality, this virtual world of the gaming world. And their resiliency, their courage, their strength, all of these things are going completely untested in the real world for a variety of reasons, whether that be the lack of positive adult male role models, the breakdown in the family system, the just disconnect in family systems, the shift in the economy where both parents are often out of the home for significant periods of time because they're both working full time, et cetera. But that's one of the big ways that they're seeing it impacting young males is this complete disconnect from the world because the only place that they have been able to find that they have what it takes, and I say that in air quotes because that's a major heart question for young men as they're doing identity formation. The only place they've had that question answered in some degree is in an online digital format. And so they completely disengage from the real world because they have not been tested. They don't have that emotional regulation. They don't even have the feedback and the skill set to say, what is it like to pursue a romantic relationship with another person and to do that in person? And yeah, it's a very interesting space, and a space that, please hear this, older generations, has never been seen before in humankind. And that is because of ever-changing technology. You can look through our span of history and see how major introductions of technological advancements have impacted the way that people do relationship. And this one is happening at a neurological level for young people.
So where's the hope here as we come to the end of this podcast? Where's the, someone's already raised their kids, they're not concerned about kids and cell phones and that kind of thing. Where's the takeaway?
That we never more so than ever has humanity been in need of real world relationship. This is for educators. This is for people that are trying to grandparent. I mean, there are so many avenues of relational connection for people in our community that this is, I mean, honestly, just a vital conversation that people need to be aware of. And so whether you are a retiree or whether you are a parent parenting teens or you are a young parent trying to raise kids or you are a young person that is just entering into the college world or is in high school still, if you are exploring this, it can be reversed. You can relearn these relationship skills. You can relearn how to engage with one another. You can learn what it means to engage with the real world where you're having these embodied relationships, where you're in, where you're connected to authentic community that deeply cares about you, that isn't going to just leave you, that isn't going to just walk away, that does not view relationships as disposable. And so it's very, we can rewire these things. We can change this cultural element just by simple decisions of how do we connect with people and how do we choose to spend our time.
Wow. And so people my age, younger, even can be real connectors in the world.
Absolutely. And can be catalysts for connect.
That's good.
Thank you for traveling with us today on The God Journey. You can join this conversation by visiting thegodjourney.com.